Look, I'm not playing any music because I'm only on for an hour tonight, but welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. It's my great pleasure to have back on my favorite writing doctor, Dr. David Ansel. Your first book, David, was really good. This one is remarkable. It's called The Death Gap, How Inequality Kills. And if the whole title puts you off a bit, let me tell you that this is not a book written for academics. It's written for all of us. I'm not a doctor, and I devoured this thing. It's got an incredible narrative. I'm going to read you how the preface begins. David writes, you don't mind me reading.
No,
David,
please. Yeah, thank you for
having
me.
Most authors are flattered by this. We all die, but tens of thousands of Americans die too early. These early deaths are not random events. These deaths strike particular individuals who live in particular American neighborhoods. And while we know that people die of cancer, heart disease, and so on, this killer isn't one that we can treat with drugs, therapy, or surgery. This killer is inequality. And you do a remarkable job of detailing that. We were talking just before coming on about one of the shocking statistics in this book, that in the city of Chicago, you think, oh, well, we live in America and the life expectancy is a general kind of thing. We're all going to live into our 80s. Even in this city, the disparity is shocking, is it not?
Yeah. So where we sit now in downtown Chicago, life expectancy is 85. If we were a country, if the Gold Coast, the Loop, the downtown area was a country, it would be ranked first in the world in life expectancy. Think Japan.
Yeah.
But you go seven stops down the blue line to Garfield Park, or go south down to Washington Park, right across from Hyde Park.
Right.
And life expectancy plummets under 69. If that were a country, think Iraq. And my CEO of Rush, Larry Goodman, when presented with this statistic, asked the question, when was the last time in America that life expectancy was 69? And you have to go all the way back to 1950. So seven stops on the L blue line or going south on another line, and you lose seven decades of life expectancy. The gap between the Loop, the downtown area, and Garfield Park or Washington Park is bigger than the gap in life expectancy between Haiti and the United States.
Just shocking. That was one of the dozens of revelations in Dr. David Ansel's new book, The Death Gap, How Inequality Kills. I think people need to, I do, but I know your background. You came as a young doctor to County Hospital. I'm going to say it because I was in it a number of times as a young man, a young reporter, the infamous County Hospital.
Yes, it was a group of us in medical school in upstate New York. Had heard about a doctor named Quentin Young.
Yep.
He was in Chicago. We were really interested not only in learning how to be good doctors, but understanding the root causes of disease and how societal problems and issues cause disease. That led us to decide to train at Cook County Hospital, which was at the crossroads of everything that was both right and wrong around health and healthcare in America.
What was right? What was right about it?
Yeah. Anyone could come there and get care without ever anyone asking about ability to pay.
Yeah.
And that's, as people know, is not universal in this country. And what was wrong about it was that many things were out of reach, things that we knew were possible for our patients we couldn't get when literally across the street at a place like Rush or down the street at a place like Northwestern or University of Chicago,
sure,
the best in medicine was readily available. And so that was quite shocking to us when we went there. But we did learn both to be good doctors, but also to understand that many of the conditions we were seeing at Cook County Hospital were the result of social conditions. So Quentin Young would say the embodiment of oppression.
Well, of course, and you also were dealing at the time with the last vestiges of the notorious Skid Row neighborhood that, you know, consisted of, you know, the flop houses where guys were sleeping for a quarter every night. I mean, some of the things that must have come in to your...
We saw everything.
Yeah.
We saw things that we didn't even know that were in textbooks.
Yeah.
One time, I decided to go out on a call it a house call to one of these so-called flop houses on Madison Street back in the day. It's now the West Loop. You wouldn't even know.
Oh, you couldn't. No.
You couldn't even imagine what it was like. And back in those days, at Cook County Hospital, they invented directly observed therapy for tuberculosis. Now it's used worldwide. The idea would be, rather than wait for a patient who had tuberculosis to come in, you'd find them and give them the medicine.
Oh, wow.
And I remember walking up to one of those flop houses. I was called the Jewel or the Working Man's Gem.
Oh, yeah. They always had these rarefied names.
The Star.
Yeah.
And I had seen a lot in my life, and you couldn't imagine what it was like. First of all, you open the door and you walk up the stairs and it reeks of urine. But people lived in these chicken cages.
Yeah.
And they were a whole warehouse. Imagine a whole warehouse lined on both sides with chicken cages. They had a little door, plywood, and chicken wire up on top.
So people wouldn't throw
things
at
them. And it was literally one little cot and a chest of drawers. When we went up there, the TB worker said, you know, everyone who slept in this room has died of TB.
Ugh.
And shortly after being on that visit, one visit, my tuberculosis test turned positive.
Wow.
So it was an experience you couldn't imagine. But what was really clear to us is we had these patients who were deserving of medical care.
Yeah.
Many times turned down at other hospitals or other places. And County was that place that took care of everybody.
Why were they turned down in those days?
Well, in those days, it was... for lack of insurance, or people are undesirable. We got involved, my colleagues and I, in the early 80s with the phenomenon of patient dumping. So in those days, people would show up at a hospital, need an emergency hospitalization. Yeah. They would do what we call the wallet biopsy.
Mm.
And then if they didn't have insurance, would transfer them to County. That was the usual practice, not just in Chicago,
everywhere,
all around the United States.
Oh,
but we decided the numbers went up, and this is when we began to have the rise of the uninsured in this country. We went from 100 a month, these phone calls, to 600 a month. And so we decided, this is how I actually got into academic medicine. We said, let's study this. It took us 3 weeks to find 500 patients. And the reason we were told they were transferred to Cook County Hospital was no insurance. But when we went and asked the patients, they were told no beds at the other hospital.
Ugh.
By the time we published the study, this phenomenon of patient dumping was ended by Congress. So our work and the work of others influenced Congress to pass a law that made this illegal. And it's the only form of universal health care we have.
This other group of doctors who started at County when you started, did some of them get so burned out or overwhelmed that they left? You had to.
Yes.
And one of the things that distinguishes, we've got to take a short commercial break, one of the things that distinguishes David's latest book, The Death Gap, How Inequality Kills, is he personally, you've just been listening to him talk, he has stories to back up. He has stories to enliven the narrative. It's not like I once heard that this guy did this. I'll read you a little something when we come back from this commercial break. This is a very personal journey into the inequities of the healthcare system, not only here in Chicago, but
across the
nationwide. Welcome back to After Hours with me, Rick Hogan, and my guest, Dr. David Ansel, the author of The Death Gap, How Inequality Kills. Just to show you what a good intuitive writer David is, he writes this. In my 17 years at County, meaning County Hospital, not once did one of my patients who needed a joint replacement for debilitating arthritis get one. Even now, 30 years later, there's at least a 5-year waiting list for joint replacement at Schroger, which it's now called. Then he says, when I was on the front lines at County and Sinai, my patients were uninsured, black and Latino, and poor. Here he writes, I did the best I could for my patients. I rationalized that the care I was giving was good enough. But when I reached Rush, where he now resides, and saw an institution awash in medical wealth, I knew I was wrong. That was the revelation of your career, was it not?
Yes, I had believed that if enough people like me showed up at places like County or Sinai or rural hospitals or federally qualified health centers in poor neighborhoods, we could make a difference. And we did make a difference.
Yeah.
But it was by no means good enough. And the palpable inequality, I call my experience on Ogden Avenue in Chicago.
Yeah.
Because I worked 17 years at Cook County, 10 years at Mount Sinai, and now I've
Rush,
been at Rush
yeah.
for a little over a decade. One street, two worlds.
Yep.
Because on that one street, a little over a mile of Ogden Avenue, there were two worlds of healthcare, but also the lives of the patients and the individuals who the institution served were so palpably different.
Oh.
And yet they were seemed invisible to my many of my colleagues when I got to Rush, because one rarely gets—
I never saw them.
One rarely yeah. gets to see either the neighborhoods or the inside of the institutions
yeah.
That are so different. And it's all structural. It doesn't need to be. It's all designed to be this way. And that's the both the problem but also the opportunity to fix it.
Yeah. You there are just so many things to the talking about hospitals and disenfranchised neighborhoods, the way that, you know, another fascinating section of the book is the way in which we deal with crisis, the Chicago heat wave, Hurricane Katrina, and which seems to hammer the disenfranchised neighborhoods more dramatically and more tragically and more fatally
yes.
than any place else.
Well, imagine this, you know, you got a heat wave like we had in Chicago in 1995
yeah,
and Katrina in 2005, or what we just saw in Houston and Puerto
yeah, exactly,
Rico,
sure.
And these things. And those are natural disasters. And what I speak of in these chapters, well, one is it doesn't matter what the illness is.
Right.
It targets the poor
yes.
Inequitably, unfairly. But more than that, even during those natural disasters, it's when CNN shows up and FEMA in bombardier jackets, and suddenly we see these neighborhoods like Katrina, which is a part of America, suddenly becomes visible.
Yep.
And yet it is visible if you just travel, you know, down Ogden Avenue, take the blue line west. But this is true in every
city major, no question.
Has an Ogden Avenue
yep.
with these neighborhoods. And when you concentrate poverty, and this concentration of poverty didn't occur by accident, but when poverty is concentrated, when people suffer not only the burden of poverty, but when they're surrounded by poor people as well, it just saps life away from.
And it also, David, one of the other things I get from your book, Dr. David Hansel, and again, the book is The Death Gap, How Inequality Kills, if hospitals become only places where, and doctors become only people you see in times of crisis, there is no sense of trying. Do you know what I mean? Do you know what I mean? There's no
yeah.
framework for the people growing it. Doctors and hospitals are not part of their lives, and as a result, health is not part of their lives
yes.
until there's a problem.
I think there's a couple things with this. If you look at, I talk in The Death Gap, How Inequality Kills,
yeah.
about giving a talk, and I use a picture, and it's a 16-year-old young black teenager, and I have his smiling face on the slide, and I note that he has a 50% chance of living to the age of 65, and that's from an article in the American Journal of Public Health extracted.
Yeah.
And when I ask the audience, why is that true? Someone's arm shoots up, and they always say, in every audience, that the cause is violence. and thinking it is gun violence. And certainly in Chicago and other major cities, gun violence is a big problem.
No question.
But the problem is caused by something I call, it's not my word for it, Paul Farmer and other folks have used it, structural violence. The idea that people's lives are actually cut short by the laws and procedures and the way things are that keep people stuck in place and unable to escape these neighborhoods. So you could put a doctor and nurse on every corner and not impact the health. Now, the major causes of death, the reason why life expectancy in Garfield Park and Washington Park are under the age of 69 back in 1950 is because of heart disease, of cancer, and diabetes, and infant mortality. Now, certainly gun violence contributes, but it's not the major contributor. And the root cause of it, you cannot explain so much disease prematurely by simply biological causes.
Yeah.
It's the concentration of all of that poverty and other things in these neighborhoods.
Well, because poverty, we can talk for 8 hours about this. You know, poverty in this town has taken grocery stores and fresh food and replaced it with fast food operations.
Yes.
And that's what people have to eat.
So you have to get the root cause. Why is it this way?
Yeah.
And what's happened is these are neighborhoods where populations were segregated by policy, procedure, law.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of work that used to be there, good factory jobs,
vanished.
There's been years and years of disinvestment in these neighborhoods.
Yep.
And then as a result, as a consequence, people then get illness and they die early as the bodily manifestation of what you call this type of oppression. It's showing inner city America, like black neighborhoods and Latino neighborhoods in inner city America is one visualization of it. But this is actually now affecting white America as well.
I know. It's a remarkable book. And as you write in it, I'm going to keep you through the news for a few more minutes afterward. It is a very, very compelling read, The Death Gap, How Inequality Kills, because in part it's set in Chicago and another large part because David Ansel is a very, very good storyteller. He writes in here, I hope that this book will serve as a clarion call for the fair-minded readers to join the fight against the structural forces that perpetrate inequality in America. We'll continue on with him and talk about what, I guess we can talk about for, 10 minutes after the news. What can we do? Because I think that because anybody who reads this book, and the last section is called The Cure, will be screaming, we got to do something. And that's my hope, of course.
Things we can do.
Yeah, good. You're going to explain that to people. We'll continue on with Dr. David Ansel, whose book is the book must be getting incredibly well received from your colleagues. Yeah?
It has been very well received.
Yeah, I'll bet. And, boy, I'll bet.
But it's a sobering read.
No question. But the fact that you also personalize it with personal stories is what is what really, really drives the narrative. If it were just, this study said this study did this, you personalize it, and that's the real strength of this. So please stay tuned. Welcome back to the abbreviated After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. I hope you've been listening for the first half hour of this hour-long show to Dr. David Ansel, How Inequality Kills. The title of the book is The Death Gap, and it's really something. The inequality, it shows up in striking and horrifying numbers, but also in people's lives. And David has a marvelous way of allowing his personal story to drive the narrative of this. We have talked about how certain neighborhoods and areas in this town have a life expectancy that is 16 years less than certain other neighborhoods in this town, this one where we're sitting at the Tribune Tower. And it's not because of gun violence. One of the things about gun violence, and as well as I do, there are more people killed 15 years ago by gun violence, and it's now because gunshot wounds are there are ways to take care of them that didn't exist 15 years ago.
Yes.
People who would die aren't dying anymore. David, what in the 10 minutes, I know it's pathetically short time, but the problem seems to me to be it's economic, it's so many different things that how do we start?
Well, I make the point in the death gap that this is not just a Chicago phenomenon.
No,
Chicago is a great place to see it and make it visible, but it's a national phenomenon.
Yep.
We've had the big drop in life expectancy among non-college-educated whites, particularly women. Half of the whites in America are poor, are non-college-educated. And what's been driving this is the growing wealth gap and income inequality. Economists have called these diseases of despair. We didn't call it diseases of despair when they were in inner city neighborhoods, but they really are diseases of despair. So there are solutions to it, and a lot of the solutions we hear politically. So just like there are social determinants of health, like if someone's hungry, they can't ever get well. If there's not a grocery store in your neighborhood, that's a structural determinant of health. If food is too expensive.
Yeah.
But there are political determinants of health. And some of this has to do with how do we actually create jobs for people that are meaningful.
Yep.
So I can tell you some solutions we're aiming for on the west side of Chicago.
Good.
So we brought this life expectancy gap to the board at Rush of our academic medical center a year ago. And we asked the question, what more could we do as a anchor institution on the west side of Chicago for 150 years? And we decided there were a few things we could do. What if we focused our hiring on the 500,000 people on the west side of Chicago?
What a great idea.
Simple idea, right?
Yeah.
What if we took our employees and looked at them as our first community? And what we found is many of them are not putting enough away to generate wealth when they retire.
Yeah.
So how can we ameliorate that? How do we create career pathways so someone can go from a dietary technician or environmental service worker, maybe become a nurse someday?
Yeah.
And then we said, well, what about if we purchase locally? What if we aimed our purchasing to the west side? And what if we could spin off new businesses?
Sure.
And then we said, well, what about investing locally, taking some of our endowment and investing in low-income housing or community-based organizations? And what if we could volunteer locally?
What a great idea. I say it's a great idea, and it's such a simple, wonderful idea.
It's simple.
You know what I mean? Yeah, right there.
And then we asked the other institutions on the west side. Turns out the number one employer in the United States, in most states, is the hospital.
I bet.
It used to be industry. It's now it's hospital. Rural areas, hospitals are holding up the rural towns.
Wow.
But what if we can all together, so we created, pulled all the hospitals together in what we call the West Side Anchor Committee and asking the same questions. What if we all hired locally? What if we all purchased locally, invested locally? And then can we get the other businesses to be able to do this? We went out in the community and did a listening tour. And what we heard from the residents on the West Side, one is we love our neighborhoods.
Yeah.
So we've demonized these neighborhoods.
Well,
just
also,
like,
they love the neighborhoods. I've learned this all over the place in Roseland and West Pullman are all these beaten-up neighborhoods. You can beat them up, but there is still that sense of place for people.
Oh, my goodness. And just like there's implicit bias, like the idea I have about you determines my behavior about you.
Right.
When we collectively hold these ideas about neighborhoods, they predict neighborhood decline. You go on the Chicago tourism site and put your mark on the west side of Chicago, and nothing shows up.
Yeah.
But people have pride in their neighborhoods.
Of course they do.
But the other things they say is our kids are hopeless. Help our kids. Give us jobs. So we think that the health is not just health and healthcare. It's about the neighborhood and safety and the grocery store in the neighborhood. It's about jobs and economic vitality, and it's about educational outcomes. And if we can all organize on focusing on these, we think that we can make it better. It's not going to be easy.
No, it's not going to be easy, but no one's going to lose fortunes over this. It's going to lift everything up, hospital included.
Right. We actually made the aim to reduce the life expectancy gap between the Loop and Garfield Park by 50% in the next decade.
Wow.
And then saying, okay, if we want to do that, what is it going to take?
Yeah.
And it's not just medicine. Though I will say nationally, the move for single-payer health care that Bernie Sanders just put out, the idea that everyone should have the same card,
yep,
that health care is a right,
yeah,
and not a privilege, would be one thing that would level the playing field. Living wages for people, but actually career opportunities as well.
Well, yes. I mean, in a neighborhood like, in West Pullman or Lawndale or Garfield Park, to have some hope for the future.
Exactly.
Some hope, I hate to be too poetic, some reason to go on, reason to live.
Yes, there's huge amount of resilience in these neighborhoods.
No question.
And part of this is for an institution like Russ and the other institution to say to the folks in the community who have a lot of mistrust, we've been part of the problem, either by acts of commission or acts of omission, and now we're going to be part of a solution here by really investing. And if we can get the city's industries and others to jump in on this, we did a project where we invested $1 million into low-income housing, and they were hiring people who have trouble finding jobs to do this housing.
In the neighborhood.
What that million levered $5 million more dollars.
No doubt about it.
And so we said, oh my gosh, we could lever these kind of investments, perhaps improve health over the long term.
What a wonderful, hopeful note. David Ansel, a doctor and a terrific, terrific writer. The book is The Death Gap, How Inequality Kills. I'm not saying it should be the perfect Christmas gift to put under the tree, but you got to read the book because it is it's chilling, but it's also hopeful. David, it's an ongoing pleasure to know you and to read you too.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Rick.
It really is. I hope you people listen to what he had to say. We'll take a commercial break and we'll check in with Liz Garibay, and that'll be that for this hour-long show. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Welcome back. Liz Garibay is among the most interesting, committed, and passionate people I have ever met in my life. And that is not just because she is a child of Old Town, as I am. It's because she cares about the city and its history. She not only runs an outfit called History on Tap, that's historyontap.com, she is the tireless person behind efforts to have a museum dedicated to beer here. It's called ChicagoBrewsium.org. Liz, how are you? Thanks for staying up so late.
I'm good. Thanks for having me. This is not late. This is my witching hour.
Yeah, this is the heart of your day. You were having an event. I'm so excited by this event because Liz has been working to have a permanent place devoted to the art and culture and history of brewing in Chicago. And this is one of your first big events, isn't it, Liz? It's called Chicago Style, an exposition of original hot dog inspired brews. This is one of your first big events, isn't it?
Yeah, this is by far the biggest adventure we've sort of decided to take on for the Brewsium. It's been a year of sort of these mini little gatherings that range from free events to, low cost and just a kind of a variety, a potpourri of different things that fuse beer and history and culture and Chicago, of course. And it's just not a local story. It's definitely a national and international
just,
story.
Of course.
This is definitely the biggest thing we've done to date.
Well, it is Saturday, this coming Saturday, from 1 to 5. The other cool thing about it, you know me, I don't like beer. I know you've spent half your life already trying to convince me that beer is the greatest thing in the world, and I'm like, how could I have a bourbon instead? But I so appreciate your efforts, and I know that most people drink beer and love beer. This is also this Chicago-style exposition of original hot dog-inspired beers is taking place. It is worth going just to meet Liz Garibay, but it is also worth going to see the new theater on the lake. You've seen that space, haven't you?
I absolutely. When I was able to learn that we were able to do this, and it definitely the space is being donated to us.
Oh, how nice.
Because they definitely believe in what we're trying to do, and it's the first public event happening at Theater on the Lake, open to the public, and we're pretty jazzed about it because it is unbelievably beautiful. What they've done to the space. I used to go to I don't know if you guys remember, but they used to do this haunted house.
Oh yeah, sure, sure.
And it was perfect because it was all run down and kind of scary. In
yeah, it was a haunted house. It was a haunted house on its best day. They didn't really have to dress it up at all. What we're talking about is the Theater on the Lake, which is at the lake at Fullerton. If you take a cab, you can take a bus and walk from the park east to the place. But it is going to be a theater venue, a music venue, and a special events venue. And that is why this Liz Garibay's event and the Chicago style. Tell me what it is, Liz. Are you pairing hot dogs with, I'm like a beer idiot in this whole scheme of things. Maybe Bruce Elliott would be a better person to be interviewing you on the radio.
Let's not get crazy.
Yeah, okay, you're right. He's going to have a podcast one day. We both know that. But so the gist of the event is hot dogs and beer. Are there craft beer makers there and you're going to pair things? Or how is it going to work?
Yeah, so the idea is it's not so much of a pairing. The idea is that beer, of course, is so important to our history, our culture.
Oh, I know.
Beginning, and of course, here we are full circle in 2017. Beer is even more important to our everyday than it was back in the 19th century. And hot dogs, of course, there's no other foodstuff that really creates this powerful identity for us as Chicagoans other than a hot dog.
So agreed.
The two have such an amazing story and so important to our city that immediately I thought, people talk about breaking down the hot dog and all the ingredients and, being dragged through a garden and talking about immigrant stories. And it's always been very fascinating. But if you think about it, beer does a lot of the same things, right? Immigrant stories and touches on so many things. So immediately I thought it would be really neat to ask breweries in Chicago to make a beer inspired by one of the 9 ingredients on a Chicago-style hot dog.
That is a cool idea. That is a very
cool. Around to some of the awesome, awesome beer makers in town and some, so amazing the support we've gotten for the Brewseum and the team behind it. So I started going around asking a lot of the folks who make great beer in our city and said, here's an idea. What do you think? And some were like, wow, that's cool. And some people were like, well, that's interesting. And some were like, well, I don't want to make, a relish beer. But the idea is you don't have to make a beer that tastes like the ingredients.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Something inspired by it. And so that's kind of how the idea evolved and grew into what it is. And so we're going to have Chicago area breweries making a beer inspired by one of the 9 ingredients. And the best part about it was we had this commitment from all these breweries, and I said to them, I don't want you to pick an ingredient because I want this to be fun. I'm going to randomly, out of a hat, pick the ingredient and assign it to you.
Oh, how great. But all of these places, I get the sense, and you've explained this to me over drinks a number of times, that all of these many, many, ever-increasing number of craft brewers here are a really creative bunch. I get the feeling if they weren't making beer, they'd be making some kind of artwork somewhere. Do you know what I mean? They are a very, very creative bunch. And I think generalizing, of course, but they are up for these kinds of challenges.
Yeah, you know, we're really lucky to live in a city that has so many talented beer makers and breweries.
And how many are there? How many are there, do you think, Liz?
I think last count in not just Chicago, but Chicagoland, right, including suburbs
sure.
and surrounding areas, I think the last count was about 160.
Oh, my Lord.
So, yeah, we've doubled our historic high, more than doubled our historic high
wow.
from the about, you know, late 1890s, 1900s.
Well, the other nice thing about this event, and again, it is Saturday, and you can get all the information you need by going to Chicago Brewzeum. I'm not going to insult you by spelling that for you. Brewzeum, like, you know, museum, but brew.org. And sign up and go. And it's a big space. And I think you'll be able to accommodate a lot of people, and you can buy tickets. And it's also an incredible chance to see. It's the first public event at Theater on the Lake, which is going to be, and I think Liz Garibay would agree, the hottest venue. It'll be booked for weddings for the next 20 years, don't you think?
Yeah, it's pretty stunning.
Yeah.
Prairie style, you know, architecture.
Yep.
And it's got floor to ceiling windows.
So
all you see is Lake Michigan all day long.
Yeah. It just
and we're really
excited
about this.
Well, and it also, I think, Liz, this will kick off what I hope will be a series of events so we can get the Brewzeum up and running somewhere. I know you're looking at spaces around town, and I know you're going to be very, very close, and I know I'll be about the third person you'll tell when you really figure out where it is. But what you do also, when you go to brewzeum.org to get tickets to this Chicago style on Saturday from 1 to 5 at Theater on the Lake, also look at History on Tap, because Liz Garibay does these extraordinary tours. She is as in love with this city as anybody I know, and including me. So, Liz, I hope this is a grand success. Let me know how it goes, will you?
Of course. Yeah, like I said, we're really excited not only because, you know, it's a unique event, but the breweries were pretty excited because, you know, there's beer fests everywhere.
Oh, of course.
And so this one is just very, very different, and it's a very boutique in a sense, in that we only have about 300 tickets to sell.
Yeah, good.
So
it's going to be
very intimate.
I want you to sell them out. I want you to sell them out. Liz, keep me posted. And again, ChicagoBrewzeum.org. Lise Graham will put that on the show's website, and you'll be able to get it that way, or historyontap.com. Take care of your sweet self, Liz.
Thanks, Rick. Always
okay,
a pleasure.
Anytime. Me too. We'll take a little commercial break, and then we'll sign off this abbreviated edition of After Hours.